Okay, thank you very much, and thank you to the organizers, Michael and Michael, for inviting me to this very interesting meeting. So this is joint work with the three PhD students, Amal Moussa from Colombia, Andrea Minka from Paris, and Edson Bastos, who's now at the Brazilian Central Bank. So I think for this audience, I don't need to do a long introduction about the importance of systemic risk and financial stability. So what we've seen in the crisis has underlined the importance of these issues, especially contagion effects and systemic risk, and also has underlined the lack of adequate quantitative indicators for measuring and monitoring systemic risk. On the other hand, control over systemic risk has been the main motivation behind the bailouts and the discussion on regulatory reform. So the idea is that the availability of better indicators of systemic risk will surely help in elaborating a clearer picture of the state of systemic risk in the current market and also a clearer regulatory policy in the future. Okay. Now, when we talk about systemic risk, there are various issues that lead to different types of modeling and different types of questions. One is measuring the level of systemic risk in a market as a whole. So that's one issue. Here we're going to address another issue that is linked to regulatory interventions, and that's the need for indicators of systemic importance of a given financial institution or a group of financial institutions. So this is an issue that has been brought up repeatedly in the literature and in legislation. So for instance, the US the Treasury in a text issued in March 2009 already called for new legislation granting additional tools to address systemically significant financial institutions. And the idea is that once the systemically significant financial institutions are identified, they will be regulated differently. And so the text says, in determining whether to use the program for an institution, Treasury may consider the extent to which destabilization of the institution could threaten the viability of creditors and counterparties exposed to the institution directly or indirectly. So the question is, how do we actually identify or measure the systemic significance of an institution? And I think the key is in this short text, you know, the key words here are destabilization, creditors, counterparties, and indirectly or directly. Okay, so we're going to present a modeling framework in which we can make sense of all these keywords and try to answer these questions in a quantitative manner. Okay, now obviously there has been work on this in the recent literature. So for instance, indicators have been proposed for quantifying things like contagion effects. How do losses in some institutions affect large losses in other institutions? So for instance, there's this paper on COVAR by Edred and Burmeier, 2009, where basically they look at the VAR of different financial institutions, and they do a regression, a quantitative regression of losses of some banks and other banks, and they try to see how the large losses are linked together. That quantifies a little bit the contagion of these among these institutions. And there's also been some papers in which people have proposed indicators of the global level of systemic risk in the financial system. So some approaches are the paper by Lehar 2005, where basically he looks at the banking system as a gigantic portfolio, and he tries to compute the simulation-based VAR measures for this portfolio. And there's also the similar work by the IMF in 2009, their report. And there's also something that will be discussed later today. So there's this paper by Huang, Zhu, and Zhou. So I think we'll hear this afternoon, where the authors propose a market-based indicator of systemic risk in the financial system. Market-based meaning based on market observables, such as the CDS spreads, volatility, and correlation. So here I'm going to adopt a different approach, but just a word to situate our approach with respect to this literature. Well, the measures, be it COVAR or the market-based indicators, are typically based on market variables such as spreads, volatilities, and correlations. So they provide interesting analysis of past scenarios. So, for example, one can look at the events of the crisis in the light of these indicators, and they give interesting insights, but they're not necessarily forward-looking diagnosis tools. For example, it's not clear whether if you run these indicators prior to the crisis, it would give an early warning signal. And also, with the exception of the paper by Huang Zhu and Zhou, there are global indicators which do not aim at localizing or quantifying the contribution of a given institution to systemic risk. So you can have an indicator that is high, but it doesn't necessarily tell you where the systemic risk is coming from and which are the institutions that are generating this. Okay? Now, and also I think, but this is also an important distinction, is that if you look at market-implied but measures of systemic risk, they mix, if you want, objective variables with the variables that represent risk aversion, so they capture what is correctly termed in the paper by Huang Zhu and Zhou perceived systemic risk, as opposed to the unperceived or unexpected systemic risk, in, which may actually be quite different. Okay. Now, so the objectives of this work is to propose a quantitative, forward-looking approach. So it will be a simulation-based approach as opposed to a purely econometric approach from current market variables for measuring the systemic impact of a large financial institution. And the idea is that the approach being forward-looking, it could be used in the framework of an early warning system of potential future systemic losses generated from some from the default of a large financial institution. So we'll concretely propose a three measures or three indicators. I'll define them precisely in a few minutes: the default impact of an institution, the contagion index, and what we call the systemic risk index. And briefly, the idea of these indices is to combine three effects. One is the effect of correlation, that's very commonly modeled in financial models. So this is the impact of common market factors affecting the defaults. The second aspect that we would like to integrate here is network effects or contagion via counterparty risk. So this can happen even in absence of common market factors. So two counterparties may have very different exposures to market factors, but since they have a counterparty relation, this way this can generate contagion. And third, but I'm not sure I'll have time to talk about this because this is a whole discussion in itself, indirect contagion via credit risk transfer, and in particular, credit default swaps. Okay? So in the first part, I'll give some definitions and outline, you know, how these indices are constructed, and then I'll present a case study in the Brazilian banking system. So we have some interesting the data set from the Brazilian Central Bank where we have all, where we have a time series of all counterparty exposures of Brazilian financial institutions to each other. So in this case, we can actually construct the full network and study how it varies over time, look at its structure, and perform some realistic simulations of these effects that I described. And finally, in the last part, I'll show that these indicators can be used to study the influence and the efficiency of various prudential policies, but such as the impact of capital ratios and other prudential policies on the magnitude of systemic risk as measured by these indicators. Okay, so this is an outline. So first, I'll outline the network approach to default contagion that we use in our model, and then I'll define the indicators that I just mentioned. Then I'll detail how they actually behave in an empirical data set, that of the Brazilian Central Bank, and then we'll look more closely at this simulation in the empirical data set and see what makes an institution systemically important if these indicators can be related to the simple characteristics of the balance sheet of the institutions or the connectivity of the institutions in the network. And then I'll talk a little bit about the macroprudential regulation of contagion risk and how these indicators can be helpful in assessing this issue. So I think I skipped the credit default swap part, but my co-author who is here, Andrea Minka, she might discuss this, but later on in a talk she'll give in the workshop that will take place in the second part of the week. So first, why do we actually need a new framework for quantifying systemic risk? Why can't we use the indicators that we already have at our disposal that are used to measure the risk of bank portfolios, such as value at risk and the related and risk measures that are generalizations of value at risk? Well, I think that for this audience that I need to elaborate on this, basically the answer is quite short. The traditional approach to risk management looks at the portfolio of a given institution and tries to quantify how hard this portfolio will be hit by losses if the market goes against the portfolio. So it's so here is the market, here is my portfolio, and I'm looking at how losses flow inward if the market moves against me because of volatility and correlation. Here we're here concerned with the opposite question, which is how much will I hurt the market if I default or if I incur a large loss. So here we're looking at the same question, but where all the arrows are reversed. So in the first case, I'm dealing with the marginal distribution of my loss, of my portfolio's loss. In the second case, we're dealing with the joint distribution of the losses of different financial market participants. So clearly, I can have situations where I have identical marginal distributions, but they come from very different joint distributions. So this is so this shows that no matter how precisely I can quantify the value at risk or the quantize of the loss of a given institution, that doesn't tell me much about how they're interlinked together. So clearly, what we need is a measure that takes into account the interconnectivity of the institutions and not just how their margin of risk is. And I think a striking example of this is the well-known example of long-term capital management. So here is a fund whose size at the height of its activity was around $4 billion. And in August 98, according to the data provided to me by the CFO of LTCM, the daily VAR of this fund was around 400 million in August 98. So I'm not focused on the VAR as a risk measure. So let's say that the magnitude of losses of this fund at the height of its losses were around $400 million in August 98. Now, these are big numbers, but compared to what we've witnessed in the last 2 years, this looks like small change. So the question is, how could a fund with this size be a threat to the financial stability of the U.S. banking system and lead to an intervention of the Fed? Well, the reason is that what is not clear in these big numbers is that LTCM had many counterparties, had all the large institutions, all the large investment banks as counterparties, and these counterparties typically had large exposures to LTCM. So what's hidden in this number of 4 billion is the leverage of LTCM that doesn't show up, of course, in the VAR. So I can have a VAR of 400 million with a leverage of 10 or with a leverage of 1 or 100. That doesn't show up in the VAR figure, but that's, of course, a very important question when thinking about the threat of the default of this institution to financial stability. So this example shows that, first of all, a firm can have a small specific risk or marginal risk, so as the measured by VAR, for instance, and be a source of large systemic risk, as was the case of LTCM. And the second issue is that systemic impact is not really not just related to size, but defined as the net value, but related to exposures that represent a potential losses as opposed to actual losses observed in the VAR. Okay, so here is the example that will define a little bit how we'll approach the problem. And as another example, we can compare the case of LTCM with Amaranth. So Amaranth, that defaulted a few years after LTCM, had a size that was roughly 2.5 times that of LTCM. However, the default of Amaranth hardly made headlines. It had an impact on a very small niche in the market, that was the natural gas market, but it didn't have a systemic impact. So actually, if you think about the position LTCM had in the market as a whole, it was really behaving like a clearinghouse. So the positions of LTCM were quite analogous to that of a clearinghouse, since it had large long and short term positions which were nearly symmetric in these convergence trades. But unlike a clearinghouse, it was not regulated, and it did not have the capital requirements to face the margin calls that were generated at the time it started having large loss. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So here, if you look at the VAR, that doesn't show up, because the VAR does not show whether you're generating this from highly leveraged position or a position with small leverage. Sorry? Yeah, it should, but it doesn't. So in another world, it would. Okay. Exactly. Yeah. So that's my point. So I think that we agree. Okay. So for instance, if you look at hedge fund data, it's not always clear how much the leverage of the fund is. Okay. If you look at hedge fund databases, you see numbers on the risk, but you don't see how much the leverage generates these numbers. Okay. So the idea in this approach is to look at is to draw some lessons from the example of LTCM and other similar examples, and to take into account the fact that the systemic impact of the failure of an institution will depend on the extent to which it has a large number of counterparties, how much exposure the counterparties have to this institution, and so on, and to have a nice representation of the counterparty relations between market participants. What we propose is an approach in which we model the state of the financial market as a network, and the network here is defined as a weighted directed graph. So where the nodes of the graph are the market participants, so in principle, the nodes should include all the relevant market participants, not only banks, but also the corporate borrowers and lenders, hedge funds, insurers, and monolines. In practice, we'll see that in our data set, unfortunately, we only have banks and some corporate borrowers and lenders, but not other participants, since they're out of the scope of the central bank. And the links between these nodes will represent counterparty exposures. More precisely, if I have a link from J to I, EJI, I will put a weight on this link that will be the exposure of I towards J. So EIJ is the exposure of I towards J, and this symmetric way say that EJI is the value of the liabilities of I towards J. So here, obviously, we're looking at financial institutions, and so the positions of a pair of financial institutions can be very complex. They're derivatives, they're bonds, they have different maturities. So what is EIJ? Well, it's the market value in a framework in the current framework of fair valuation of market positions. It's a mark-to-market value of the exposures of I to J. Okay. So here, I'm ignoring the difficulties that are linked to different short and long maturities. So in the take, in the first talk this morning, we saw the importance of the maturity, the mismatch. So here, I'm looking at the fair value, and of course. In large investment banks, these counterparty exposures are closely monitored. Most large investment banks and financial institutions actually compute their exposure to their large counterparties every day. So this kind of information is available in these institutions and monitored. Okay. In addition to these links, each institution disposes of a capital buffer that are called the CI. So I will view this, the capital buffer, as the capacity of the institution for absorbing the market losses. So in a practical implementation, we'll need to specify what is this capital buffer. So in my context, I will use the I1 plus 2 own capital from which I subtract the required regulatory capital for non-banking actors. And so more precisely, I will have a stylized, we have a stylized representation of the balance sheet of the institutions in the network. On one hand, I have the assets of the financial institution. So some of these assets will be held against counterparties that are in the network. So I call these interbank assets. So interbank includes all the nodes in the network. They're not necessarily banks, as I said, but we'll call them interbanks just for the purpose of the discussion. And then I'll have some non-financial assets. So in the model, we'll be looking at the short-term impact of a failure of a financial institution. So I'll assume that in the short term, these non-financial assets are variation in the non-financial assets will be negligible in the short term. It doesn't mean the volume is negligible. It just means the variation will be neglected. On the liability side, I have what I call interbank liabilities, so liabilities with other counterparties in the network. Technically here, they're also the deposits, but again, I'll consider the case where the deposits have a small variation in the short run, and then there's the capital that I just defined, the capital, the buffer of the bank. Okay. Now, starting from such a network structure, the question is, what is the impact of the failure of a node on the rest of the network? And of course, this is an issue that has been studied a lot in the literature, so I'm not going to summarize the whole literature here, but the idea is that, well, typically, in the network-based literature in finance, this problem has been studied in two cases. One is in the case of very simple network structures, either completely connected networks or networks in which all banks lie in a circle and you look at the nearest neighbor effect. In these cases, it's easier to obtain analytical results, but typically, these networks have very little resemblance to actual banking networks. And these studies, however, suggest that the magnitude of contagion will depend crucially on two factors at least: the size of interbank exposure relative to capital. That's not very surprising, and also on the precise structure of the linkages of the network. And that's less comforting, since it means that you actually have to look at the empirical structure of the network. You can make some general statements which will hold for any network. So that's somehow unfortunate. On the other hand, there is a large empirical literature on contagion effects or domino effects in financial networks. So these studies have been done exclusively by teams in different central banks. So these are the teams that have had access actually to this exposure data, interbank exposure data. So here's a list of this in different countries. So typically in these studies, what has been done is the following. We look at the interbank exposures at a given point in time, and then we look at the cash flows that occur if there is a default of a node in the network, and if you consider the liabilities and assets as effective cash flow. Okay, so in fact, when you look at liquidation, a theoretical situation in which the institutions and network are simultaneously liquidated, and you see who is the solvent to who is insolvent in the final state where everybody is liquidated. So most of these studies have focused on payment systems, such as the Fed wire, and the focus has been the stability of these payment systems. So these studies do not look at the whole balance sheet of the bank, but just at some specific category of assets and liabilities that are these overnight exposures. And all of these studies have reported very small loss magnitude. So they conclude that, you know, these domino effects exist, but they're ridiculously small. They're so small that they can be safely neglected. So that's the conclusion of most of the studies that I quote here. Now, in fact, in the Geneva report, the report that was written by a group of economists in August 2008, they didn't choose the best date for the report. yes, so these studies of the central banks are cited to claim that, you know, these domino effects can exist, but they're very small, so they can safely be ignored. So the domino effects have a very small impact on contagion, and they cite these studies as a proof of this, of the small magnitude of such a domino effect. But here, what we claim is that, in fact, these studies are quite misleading since they ignore the two issues. One is that, in fact, if you read these papers, all of them, except the study of the Italian central bank, actually they are not based on actual exposures of banks to each other, but they estimate exposures from aggregate the balance sheet data. So in other words, they say, well, we have this matrix of interbank assets and interbank liabilities, so we need to fill the matrix, so we need to see what is the weight on each link in the network. So there are n squared variables, there are n nodes, and unfortunately, but we don't have all this data, so what we know is the total assets and total liabilities of each bank, which means we know the sum on each row and the sum on each column, and we're going to infer or reconstitute the matrix by assuming something. So typically in the papers that I cited, more than half of them use the maximum entropy technique. So that means, in a nutshell, it means that you're going to take the most uniform distribution of exposures possible that verify the constraints of having a given set of aggregate assets and liabilities. Now, as we'll see later, if we look at this particular algorithm for estimating the actual exposures, this is typically the configuration which minimizes contagion, because in a network with a given size for balance sheets, the best configuration that you could have is where you distribute equally your exposures among counterparties, so you don't have a huge exposure to any counterparty, you have lots of small exposures. Unfortunately, as we'll see in the empirical example of the Brazilian network, the distribution of exposures is very far from being uniform. It's actually a heavy tail distribution, which is closer to a Pareto distribution. So this can lead to a severe underestimation of contagion effects. And the other thing is that these simulations actually look at the default of a given institution, everything else being held equal. So in particular, the capital levels, the capital buffers of all other nodes in the network are assumed to be invariant as a large institution the default. So this is also highly unlikely, because the default of a large institution happens not completely exogenously, but due to large market losses. And if you assume that the other institutions in the network also hold portfolios that have exposure to the same market factors, it is highly unlikely that in the scenario of a large default, the other institutions will also be subject to a similar shock. So in other words, the impact of a correlated market shock on balance sheet is neglected in the simulations. Okay, so let me skip to what we're doing here. So here, the idea is to look at the impact of the default of an institution on the network, and we're going to integrate at least these two factors, which are a default contagion across counterparty networks, and the other one is the fact that, well, to start with, the shocks that create the defaults are correlated shocks across the institutions. They're not independent. Okay, so how does this work? Well, initially, an institution can default because of an exogenous shock. So this can arise from either loss in its portfolios, and this is the model by applying the shock epsilon I to the balance sheet of institution I, and if the capital of the institution is insufficient to bear the shock, the institution defaults, or it can arise from margin calls or payments on derivatives, but such as credit default swaps, for instance, and also in this case, if the institution has insufficient capital, it defaults. So in the simulations that I will show, I'll focus on the first case. I think I will not have time to talk about the correct defaults to have some derivatives here, but that is included in the final version. Now, once an institution by default, because of an exogenous market shock, it's by default can propagate in the network but to its counterparties, and so typically the counterparties that have an exposure but to this institution can lose a fraction of their exposure, okay, in this way. So if J is exposed to I and I defaults, they will have a loss of 1 minus a recovery rate but times its exposure to I. Now, if the loss exceeds its per capita of the buffer, then the counterparty J also defaults. Okay, in practice, it's important to specify a value in the model for the recovery rate. Now, if we look at long-term per recovery, so if we wait until liquidation has been fully done, this per recovery rate can actually be high, and it's endogenous. It depends on the assets and the liabilities of the defaulted institution. But however, in the short term, and here we're looking at the short-term impact of a default on counterparties, in the short term, the recovery is zero. So in practice, if you have $1 billion exposure to a counterparty and the counterparty defaults, in the short term, your assets are frozen with this counterparty. So you cannot use those assets to pay off a margin call or to actually liquidate against a loss on some other position in the portfolio. So in the short term, it's reasonable to take a recovery that is zero or close to zero. Okay, another issue here is that here we're basically saying that if the assets have a loss of epsilon, then the loss in the capital, then the decrease in the capital buffer is also epsilon. So in practice, if you think about a structural type of model, such as the Merton model, what these models tell us is that, well, actually, the loss, the decrease in the level of the capital is not epsilon, but it's something smaller than epsilon, and the ratio is a sensitivity that depends on the leverage or the debt ratio of the firm. Okay, so typically, the information that you need in a structure of the model to compute this sensitivity involves a lot of assumptions on the capital structure, the maturity of the debt, and the volatility of the assets. And so here, these considerations can be integrated in the model in a practical way, in an operational way, without assuming a lot of detail about the maturity of the debt and so on. So here we're not interested so much in the long-term evolution of the capital structure. We're looking at a cross-section of the system at time t, and we're interested in seeing what is the short-term impact of a loss. So in this case, I can integrate these effects by assigning between each institution a multiplier that is a function of the debt ratio of the firm I. And in practice, what we'll do is we'll split the institutions into two or three categories: high, low leverage, or high, but medium, and low leverage, and use the three values of the multiplier for these institutions. Okay, now, unlike the mechanism of exogenous by default but due to market shocks, the default of an institution but due to losses from counterparties can generate what is called a default cascade. Intuitively, it's very clear. Institution I defaults, then it generates a large loss for its counterparty J that can also default, and then the counterparties of J can also default since they if they have a large exposure to J, and so on. So it can be used to define what we call the default cascade. So formally, is defined in the following way. I'm interested in seeing the cascade of defaults that is generated by the initial default of a subset A of the nodes. So A can be a single node or can be a whole sector. So I start from the nodes in A. So initially at round zero, all the nodes in it the default, and then at each round, I'm going to look at all the guys who were exposed to the institution that have already been defaulted. I compute their losses due to counterparty default. So I look at the sum of their exposures to guys who have already been defaulted. If the losses due to their counterparty exposures exceed their capital of the buffer, these guys also default, and we continue the iterations until it stops. Okay, so I call the default cascade the sequence of these default events, and it can be shown that in a graph with n nodes, this iteration stops at n minus 1 rounds at most, and in fact it stops in most cases, it stops at 1, 2, or 3 rounds maximum in practical examples. Okay, so now having defined the default cascade, I can define the default impact of an institution. So the default impact of an institution is simply the following thing. We start from the event where all the institutions in set A the default, then we run the cascade. So the cascade will generate the defaults of a subset of the nodes in the graph. And then we compute the total loss along the cascade. So what is the total loss? The sum. So it's a sum over all the institutions that have defaulted. So of the capital of these institutions that has been lost due to default, and then their default also generates a loss in their counterparties' portfolio. So this is the sum of all the non-defaulted institutions, sum over non-defaulted institutions, of their exposures to the defaulted institutions. So what we lose is the capital of the defaulted institutions and the exposures of the guys who are still in the network to those who have defaulted. Okay? It's an intuitive thing that we call the default impact of a set of institutions A. So, and obviously, it depends on the level of the capital buffers and on the matrix of exposures E. Okay? A special case is when we look at a single institution defaulting. Okay, I use the same definition. I start from institution I, it defaults to generate cascade, and I sum along the cascade the losses of everybody. Okay, so now note that this is a deterministic simulation. If you give me the capital buffers and the exposures, I can compute this by iteration. It's very simple. It's actually worst case loss estimate. It does not involve any estimation of the probability of default of I. I look at a scenario, what if I default? I don't ask myself at this point, what is the probability of I default? Okay? Now, obviously, so, in fact, in this situation, so this is, in fact, the type of the simulation that we see in some of the studies I quoted from the central banks. They actually look at the default of a given institutions and they see how much it spills over to the counterparties. It's exactly the definition of this default impact. But of course, as we said, it's rather artificial but to look at this scenario where you have a large bank defaulting and the capital, the levels of other banks stay the same as before. So that's not very likely. So we can compute the loss in that scenario, but that scenario might not be very likely. So in order to incorporate the fact that that defaults often happen in stress scenarios, which correspond typically to a market loss affecting balance sheets in the network in a correlated fashion. What we do is the following: we're going to apply correlated shocks to the balance sheets in the form of a shock to the values of the capital of these institutions. So think of a one-period model in which I have the initial state of capital, Cj, and then I apply a shock to the balance sheet. So sorry, this should be I and I or J. So I apply shock to all these balance sheets, and the shock is in the form of a set of correlated random variables. So the shocks apply to different balance sheets follow some multivariate distribution that has some dependence in it. I'll give some examples in a minute, but it's easy to incorporate here a lot of different structures. And now I'm going to look at, in some of these scenarios, of course, the level of the capital buffer of J will be insufficient to contain the market loss to it by the market shock, and in these scenarios it will default. Okay? And now I will look at the scenarios where an institution A defaults due to these exogenous market shocks, and only in those scenarios I'm going to compute the default impact of R. Okay? Now, in this case, the default impact of R, so I'm just using the definition that I gave previously, I'm computing the default impact of R in the cascade, only I'm doing it in a scenario where the level of the capital buffers is not the initial level, it's a stress capital buffer where I've applied correlated charge to everybody. So now, it's exactly the same computation as before, except that now this is now a random variable since these shocks are random. Okay, and examples of the multivariate distributions that we use in the simulations, there are many examples. So typically here, I can use any of the models that I use in default risk simulations. There are models out there for dependencies in credit portfolios. There are factor models, heavy tailed or not heavy tailed. One can use the dynamic models. So here, the point is not the choice of the factor model. The point is that I need to incorporate correlated charts across the nodes. And now, having defined this default impact in a stress scenario, I define what I call the contagion index of a node as simply the expected default impact in a scenario where I default. So the contagion index of I is the expected default impact of I, so it's the expected loss along a cascade that is generated by the default of I. And I take the expectation, of course, only across the scenarios where I default. In the scenarios where I doesn't default, the default impact is zero by definition. Okay, so here, this expression here, this conditional expectation, but combines the two things. The expression inside the expectation is the default impact. So, of course, the default impact will take into account these network effects that we discussed earlier, and the fact that I compute the default impact in stress scenarios affecting everybody will incorporate the market correlations. The fact that the defaults are not completely independent but are generated by the same market factors across counterparts. So I lend money to everybody. Well, so here it doesn't mean that I default in every scenario. It depends on the capital. Okay, so I default in every scenario. So what does that? Conditional I defaulting? No. Why is that so? Yeah. So no. But here, if I default in every scenario, then I can take the conditioning away since there is no conditioning. So true all the time. That doesn't imply that. No, it's the other way around. So here, in the default impact, being large makes no statement about the probability of the default of I. Okay, so a company can have a large default impact even if the probability of its default is extremely low. Okay, so here, actually, a firm will have a large default impact if it has a lot of liabilities. So it's when it defaults, the loss will flow to everybody else. Okay, if it has a huge amount of assets but very low liabilities, then the default impact will be low. although its probability of default will be high. Yes. Yes, so I'll come back to that a little bit later. I'll look at in the Brazilian network, what is it that makes the systemic risk index or the contagion index large? Okay, so at this point, I'm just defining it, but obviously it will be linked to the size of the liabilities and the number of institutions in the graph holding a liability against this firm. Yeah. But here, the point is that assets and liabilities play a very asymmetric role. So typically, balance sheet will have the same amount of assets and liabilities roughly, but not necessarily, since we're only interested in interbank liabilities. So if I have a large quantity of non-banking assets and a small quantity of banking assets, and then I have big interbank liabilities, it will be very different in terms of the default impact than the opposite. Yes. So here I'm looking at a short-term situation where there is no contagion from fire cells. That could be integrated into the model, like in the IMF the report. Well, they say, well, additionally to all this, there is also the fact that there are fire cells. So, but that's very hard to quantify, since if you look at fire cells, if you want to be serious about that, then the question is, well, what is in the portfolio of this institution being liquidated? Okay. Because it's mainly the assets in the portfolio that will be sold off in the market. So there, it's not sufficient to know what is the amount in market fair market value of the exposure. I need to know if these are market-backed securities, or stocks or bonds or whatever. So here, I don't have that detailed information, so I'm not making a statement. Of course, it's important. So what I can say only at this level is that this will. Since the fire sale will exacerbate the losses to the counterparties, what we do here is a lower bound to what's. But on the other hand, I don't think that this kind of crude modeling should be taken seriously, quantitatively speaking. I think that these indicators that we're defining here should be seen as ordinal indicators. So we're going to look at them to order rank institutions. The exact number in dollars, is it something that you can take seriously? I'm not sure if at this level of stylized balance sheet modeling you can do that. But I think for fire sale, you need at least some categorization of assets into the different asset classes. In this case, in our database, there is no such information, unfortunately. Okay, and the third concept is what we call the systemic risk index. So here, the point, and I think it's an important point, is that the mere occurrence of losses in the financial system is not itself a manifestation of systemic risk. So for instance, if the institutions that bear the losses of large hedge funds, or whose counterparties are essentially other hedge funds, as was the case of Amaranth, for instance, this may not be a manifestation of systemic risk. So usually, at least in my understanding, systemic risk refers to a situation where these losses spill over to the economy, so outside the financial system. So to capture this feature in the simulation, we will distinguish a set of core institutions that are typically lending institutions or deposit-taking institutions, whose default is considered harmful or undesirable, as opposed to other institutions whose default is not necessarily considered a systemic event. Okay, and the same definitions apply, except that now here I'm going to sum the losses only over the core institutions, but otherwise the definitions are exactly the same. So here the institutions that can generate the losses can be any one in the network, but then I'm going to look at the losses only over core institutions. Okay, now let me skip this, okay? So now In the second part, I'm going to look at the how these indicators behave in the case of a real network, and that's the Brazilian financial network. Okay, and so this study is based on a data set that was provided to us by the Brazilian Central Bank. If you plot the graph that I defined earlier, it looks a little bit like this. So what we see is that clearly there's a large heterogeneity in this graph. Some nodes have a very central role in the graph, have lots of counterparties, and some nodes have very few counterparties and can be considered as peripheral nodes in the network. So to summarize, the main properties of this network are that, well, we observe for all nodes all the interbank exposures. So what we see is all the financial institutions in Brazil. So in this case, they define as holdings. So holdings, so if a bank, if some banks belong to the same holding, they're actually considered in this model as a single node. So what we have is a database of time series where we see these holdings. There are roughly 100 holdings in the Brazilian financial system. There are approximately 1,000 links among these nodes. So if you do a little computation, what you have is a pretty sparse graph, since the number of possible links here is 100 squared, so it's 10,000. So it means that actually only 10% of the links exist in the graph, and the average degree of a node is around 7. However, the range of the degree, so the range of the number of counterparties, will go from 2 to 100. So some nodes are connected to everybody else in the network. Some nodes have only 2 or 3 counterparties. Okay, and so to summarize a little bit the empirical properties of the network, what we observe is that the degrees have a heavy tail Pareto distribution, and also the exposures of the links between each other have a heavy tail Pareto distribution. So the situation is very far from what was implied by the studies that use this maximum entropy technique, where the reference distribution is the uniform distribution of exposures across links. What we have is typically very heavy tail distributions that are quite stable across time. Okay, so let me skip a little bit. Okay, now in this network, we use two different definitions for the capital, the buffer. So the first definition is the time one, the capital, corrected for the degraded capital for the non-banking assets, since in these institutions there is a big proportion typically of non-banking assets, non-financial assets, including for instance the real estate, or for the non-financial institutions their physical assets. So here we're only interested in the financial assets, so we will correct for this. So we're going to compare two situations where we look at tie one and tie two, and only tie one. So the second situation is of course more conservative, and it's more close to for instance the stress test conducted in the U.S. In 2009, where they used also as a capital the buffer, the tie one. Okay, now I skip the simulation part. So in all the results, I'm going to show you the contagion index and the systemic risk index are computed by simulation. Now it's clear intuitively that we're looking at rare events, so we're looking at cascades of default. So a naive Monte Carlo simulation is bound to be very lousy. So in this approach, what we use is the two ingredients for the simulation, for improving the simulation. So we use in a crucial way the conditional independence, the fact that you can separate into common factors and idiosyncratic factors, and the fact that in these specifications that I showed you earlier, it's actually possible to compute in closed form the conditional distribution of the loss of each institution, conditional on the fact that it has to default. Okay, so this is how the simulations are done, but I'm not going to skip this part. Okay. So here are some results. So what we see here is the distribution of the default impact and the contagion index, but computed for all nodes in the network. So each point on the graph is one institution in the network. And what we observe is that if we plot this on a log-log plot, not but surprisingly, given that if we start from a network structure that is highly heterogeneous, the distributions of these indices are also very heterogeneous. So in other words, we have a few nodes in the network that have very high default impact and very high contagion index, and a large number of nodes that have very low contribution both to contagion and systemic risk. And the scale here is as a proportion of total assets in the Brazilian economy. So it's the total size of all the balance sheets in the system. So it means that some nodes here can destroy up to 10% of the assets in the Brazilian banking system if they default, and the vast majority of the nodes have an impact that is smaller than a fraction of a percent. Okay, so that's again the distributions in another format. So here is the impact of contagions. So here I plot the default impact of an institution versus the contagion index. So recall that if there is no impact of common factors, the default impact is the same as the contagion index. So if the default happened independently, there is no a difference between the two. So all the points should lie on this straight line. So what we observe is that, well, typically there's the majority of the points lie above the line, and this is a log-log plot. So if this point is slightly above the red line, it means that actually here the contagion index is 10 times higher than the default impact. And it's clear in this graph where we plot the ratio of the contagion index to default impact. So what we see is that this can range from 1 to 15. So for some institutions, if we take into account that simultaneously contagion and the fact that they're correlating market shocks, actually what we get is an impact of contagion that is 10 to 15 times higher than what would be revealed by purely deterministic simulation as done in the central bank study. Okay, so here is now, let me skip this. Okay. So now the question is, what makes a node systemically important? Okay, so obviously the first thing you would think of is size. And here, as I said, assets and liabilities play a very asymmetric role. So what we see on the left is that if you compare the contagion index to the interbank liabilities, then what we see is a strong correlation among with these things. Okay. However, if you look at the relation among the assets and the contagion index, it's not a clear relation. So it's a very domestic relation. So clearly, it's asymmetric. The losses flow in from the asset side; they flow up via the liability side. So here we're clearly looking at the outflows. So we're what is the relevance is the size of the interbank liabilities. But as we see again, here is a log-log plot. So here there is any deviation from the straight line here can be significant. So for instance, here we have institutions that have the same interbank liability size, but some of them have a contagion index that is 10 times higher than the other. So the question is, what is at play here? What distinguishes these institutions? Okay, so here clearly that's where we're going to see the network effects. And to understand this, we're going to define some simple indicators. So these indicators can be defined by looking at a single institution and its exposures. Okay. And the main thing that we're going to look at is the susceptibility of I to J. So the susceptibility is the fraction of the capital of an institution that is wiped out if the counterparty defaults. So it's a exposure. It's the ratio of the exposure but to the capital. And I'm going to look at all the counterparties of a given node, and I'm going to ask myself, well, what is the is the harm that I can inflict to my counterparties if I default? Well, the easy answer is I look at the harm in dollars, and that's I just look at the at the liabilities I have. But the most interesting thing here is that how much, what fraction of the capital of my counterparties I can be destroyed if I default. And here is defined by this number here that we call the local net worth frailty. So that's a maximum across the counterparties of I of this ratio, and that's the exposure that I have to J by divided by the capital of I. Okay, and clearly what we see is that if we look at the nodes that have the five largest contagion indices in this network, what we see is that they also have a local frailty that is high, and the local susceptibility of the counterparties that is also high. Okay, and yes, so and statistically speaking, one can do a stepwise regression. One can pick all these the network centrality indicators, and regress them, regress the contagion index on these. And if we do this, what we see is that the two variables that seem to be the most relevant are the total liability size, and that's not surprising. We've already seen that size matters. That it will be surprising to see the opposite, but also what we call the counterparty frailty, and that's basically what is the ratio of my counterparty's exposures to me with respect to their capital. Okay. Okay, so to summarize, the systemic impact of an institution is not purely determined from this aggregate balance sheet size, but also it depends on its counterparties, the environment of this node in the network, and the issue is then how can these observations be used in designing indicators of in designing an efficient macroprudential policy for systemic risk. And here, well, the two obvious things to look for are policies that impose a minimal capital ratio on all institutions. So here, if we think about how the loss propagates in the cascade in the model, what is relevant here is the ratio of the capital, the buffer, to the exposures, but not the risk-weighted exposures as defined in the regulatory framework, but actual exposures in dollars or euros. Okay, so here is one thing that we're going to look at. And the other thing that could be done is that, well, actually, when we look at the capital ratio, we're comparing the capital to all exposures that we sum, so we're going to look at all the assets, but actually, if we look at the network view of things, what is most important is not the total assets, but actually only the assets, only the links which bear the largest exposures. Okay, so in this view, it makes the more sense to impose a cap on susceptibility, or in other words, but to impose a minimal exposure ratio, a minimal ratio on of the capital of an institution to any single exposure. So that's this is more consistent with the network-based approach. And what we can do is to compare these things. So, for example, it's easy to see that if you impose a minimal capital ratio, it will decrease the tail of the distribution of the contagion index. So here is the case in red where there's no cap imposed, and if we impose the cap, then the tail of the distribution curve shifts to the left. So what is interesting is that we're exactly doing what we want to do. We're decreasing the contagion index in the tails of the distribution. If we decrease it in average, it may be good, but we really care about the tails. And what we see in this plot is that actually it does decrease the probability of large systemic losses. And if we plot actually the largest default impact in the network, there is a clear monotone relation. So what we say is that if we impose a minimal capital ratio here, the largest but default impact in the network decreases monotonically with the minimal capital ratio. Now, the last graph I'm going to show is a sort of efficient frontier for these different policies. So the question is, obviously, if I increase the capital requirements on everybody, I'm going to decrease the cascade size, I'm going to decrease systemic risk. The question is, at what cost? So here, what we plot is for each of these policies, so that imposes a floor on the capital ratio, cap on susceptibility, etc., I'm going to look at, on one hand, the contagion index, and here I'm plotting actually the average of the contagion index of the five most systemic institutions. So I'm going to run for each of these situations, I'm going to run the simulations, pick the institution with the five largest contagion index, take the average, and I plot this. Okay, and here I plot the total cost in capital immobilizing the system for each of these policies. So obviously, it shows that for all of the policies, if I keep increasing the amount of capital immobilizing the system, I will decrease the contagion index, I will decrease the systemic risk. But what we see is that there is a difference in efficiency. So typically, if I impose a cap on susceptibility, so that means if I only require the large institutions, but to have a limit on the exposures that they have, so not the total exposure necessarily, but on the largest exposures that they have as a fraction of their capital, this can be more efficient than imposing a global cap on the a global floor on the capital ratio that compares the capital to the sum of the assets, but does not look at the distribution of exposures across capital. Okay, so let me skip to the conclusion now. Okay, so in this study, we've proposed some indicators for contagion and systemic risk that try to account simultaneously for correlation in market shocks across firms plus the network contagion effects. And we argue that from the simulations that we do, we argue that focusing on only one of these two aspects leads to a severe underestimation of systemic risk. And we studied a little bit in these examples the characteristics of a node or an institution that lead to high values of these indicators. And I think that this approach can be interesting for incorporating spillover effects or counterparty risk into stress tests of default and systemic risk. And some of the important conclusions are that actually what we claim is that actual capital and not risk-weighted assets or capitals seem to be key to determinant of systemic risk. And in the simulations, it's very clear that imposing a minimal capital ratio or a cap on the exposure ratio, even if you restrict it to only the most systemic nodes, is an effective mechanism for reducing the default contagion and the probability of large systemic losses. And there is more to the systemic impact of an institution than just the balance sheet, the size of this institution. So I think I'll stop here.